Let me see a quick show of hands. How many of you have already started at least playing around building UWP apps? So about half, okay. How many have been using MVVM for a while and say WPF or Silverlight? Okay, so for you folks, honestly, a lot of this is MVVM fundamentals. You know, just fair warning there that hopefully it reinforces the concepts for you of how to do it right and also shows you how to plug it into the UWP arena. Okay, so a little bit about me. I'm from a company called Soliant. We had a booth out here all week. We do everything from kind of short expert consulting engagements to multi-year end-to-end project development for companies that either don't have a development staff or have a small one that can't handle their current requirements. Also a Microsoft Regional Director. That's a small program that, if you haven't heard of it, it's somewhat similar to the MVP program, except there's only about 130 of us worldwide. Not part of Microsoft, third-party advisors, and we have a little bit more direct conduit to senior leadership in Microsoft. MVP program, been in that for, I think, 12 years now. Also a Pluralsight author now, relevant to this session. There's a number of related courses in the Pluralsight library at this point. I haven't seen any pop in yet that are specifically MVVM in-depth for UWP. I have one that's called MVVM in-depth for WPF. So the conceptual part of this, you could watch portions of my WPF course and get that. And there are definitely some just general UWP courses popping in there as well. If you are not a Pluralsight subscriber and you want to check it out, just send me an email and I can get you a 1 month pass. Okay, so like I said, I'll start off kind of big picture, make sure everyone's on the same page about, you know, what UWP is all about and why you might want to use it. Then we'll get into some of the pattern fundamentals and then we'll kind of dive into the application of those fundamentals in UWP. So UWP, for those that are brand new to it, the things to be aware of there are, it's a XAML platform, primarily. There are other ways you can still build things with JavaScript, but most of the focus now is on XAML and C# or VB behind it. It's only for Windows 10, and you know, for Windows 8, for example, it was the same way about building Windows runtime applications, and that was a big barrier for most organizations because very few companies jumped right on Windows 8, and definitely if you do any work for governments, they were even slower about that. One recent announcement you may not be aware of is that the U.S. Department of Defense has already planned and is in progress on moving to Windows 10 quickly. So that's one thing that's going to help a lot as UWP developers, is that that's going to set the momentum that companies are going to be more likely to want to do that, because traditionally DoD are like the slowest ones ever for adopting new technology. And so when you're building a UWP app, it is Windows 10 only. There is no backward compatibility to Windows 7 or Windows 8 or anything like that. One other question for people in here. How many people at least played around with building Windows runtime apps for Windows 8? That doesn't surprise me. One kind of hand there. I gave talks on that stuff at TechEd US and TechEd Europe. And you know, most TechEd sessions, you'll have 100 to 200 people in there. And this wasn't just me. This was other people speaking on the topic. Generally, we'd have 5 to 10 people show up for anything to do with the Windows runtime. So this extra momentum that's out there for Windows 10 is, you know, kind of a plus there, that people see, you know, not only that Windows 10 might arrive on their desktop fairly soon and be able to build apps that exploit that, but also, you know, the multi-platform device-oriented aspects of it kind of open the range of possibilities for those devices. One thing to be aware of, if you did at least look at the Windows 8 timeframe and the design guidance around that, is Windows 8, they were very dictatorial in the recommendations about, you know, you had to be a full screen app, there were certain styling things you were always expected to do, every app looked like a grid view app, and it was kind of tiresome. And even things like how you do search, how you do settings and stuff like that were all dictated to you by the platform. Windows 10, they've relaxed all that, and they kind of go, you want to be a windowed app, you want to be a full screen app, you want to do both those, however you want to style it, you can do those. And they've added new features for things like background tasks were a big limitation. In Windows 8, you basically the best you could do is about every 15 minutes, your app could wake up and do something very short in duration and then go dormant again. Now you could do full, you know, kind of system tray type stuff from your UWP apps and be always running and doing stuff. When it comes to MVVM, the only downside is there's almost nothing in the platform that specifically guides you down the path of doing the MVVM pattern. The raw fundamentals are there. Whoops, slides auto-sequenced on me there. There we go. So you have the raw fundamentals there that are required to do the MVVM pattern, which is really rich data binding, data context, property change notifications, and data templates. But you're kind of left to your own devices about how to apply those to the pattern. So the other thing that kind of comes in when it comes to doing MVVM in Windows 10, similar to Windows 8, is that there are things about the platform that you generally do want to comply with. The navigation model, the state retention model in terms of when your app goes dormant and when it comes back to life, and restoring the user's experience. You've also got new features like the compiled bindings, XBind, which change the way you do your binding and makes you make some compromises in terms of the decoupling that you do with the MVVM pattern that I'll touch on. There's also still a lack of features. So for the hands that went up that have done this in WPF, WPF still has a lot of features in general, things like custom markup extensions, implicit data templates. These things all help you in doing MVVM, but they're not present yet on the Windows 10 platform. Let's grab a drink here. So the one other thing I kind of glossed over there on one of those slides is the programming model, the APIs of Windows 10 UWP are really just a derivative of the Windows 8 ones. So when it comes to finding samples and stuff, for example, in my Prism talk yesterday, I pointed out that if you want to find how to use Prism for UWP, go watch tutorials and videos on Prism for Windows 8, because it really is the same platform, just enhanced and opened up a little bit. So in terms of moving into the concepts of MVVM, basically, you know, it's all driven by some architectural goals of having loose coupling and separation of concerns, but those are very vague terms on their own. Those things do lead to the ILities that you care about, and mostly maintainability is one of the primary goals and testability secondarily. Extensibility in the range, apologize for the cough. Extensibility, one thing to wrap your head around when it comes to UWP, is UWP apps, like Windows 8 apps, are a packaged app model. What that means is you build your app, it gets packaged and digitally signed into an AppX package, and that's what gets deployed to the platform to run. So the implication of that is you don't have any chance to do any runtime extensibility. In WPF and even Silverlight, you could drop new DLLs in the folder and have them light up either the next time it ran or even at runtime. In UWP, you really don't have that. So extensibility is still important in terms of the maintainability of your code. It's really an extension of maintainability to make your code pluggable so that as you build new features and you want to be able to drop those in and get a new release out quickly, you know, designing for extensibility in that sense is still important. But you just realize you're not going to have any runtime extensibility. And the gist of it, even though this shows a WPF app, the principles are the same. Way too many apps have been built where you file a new project and you just start dumping event handlers and business logic and things like that into the code behind. And that's not really good enough for big, complicated applications for these architectural goals. So just to, you know, kind of make that more concrete, you look at this little chunk of code and it looks fairly innocuous. Had to be small enough to fit on a slide, obviously. But then you start picking apart what that code is actually doing, and you've got direct access to UI elements in these lines of code. You've got some data access going on here through Entity Framework, presumably, or some link provider. And then you've got some interaction or business logic here interwoven with that. So you have this, you know, in one small chunk of code, you've got four different concerns all interwoven with one another. And that's exactly the kind of thing that MVVM is trying to get you away from. The analogy I always use is putting away laundry. If you go to your go do your wash, you pull things out of the dryer, they're a big tangled mess. If you just grab that whole bundle, take it over, dump it in a drawer, or shove it in a hole in your closet, that's kind of what you're doing with code here. Because you've got your socks, your underwear, your shirts, your pants, they're all wrapped around one another, and they're hard to extract. It's a lot easier putting your laundry away, but it's a lot harder getting dressed every day to go out the door. So MVVM in a like fashion says, build some shelves, build some drawers, have a plan for what kind of code goes where, and then do that regularly. And now it's easier to, when you're going to implement a bug fix or implement a new feature, you know right where in the code you should go to put that code. And that's kind of the idea here. So this just shows kind of a folder based aspect of that, that if you're doing MVVM, in this case, and certainly you don't have to stick to this exact structure, but the idea is your presentation, exactly what you see on the screen, that would be in your views. The interaction logic that supports those screens, the data that, or the logic that gets data to the screen, takes data from the screen, and handles the user interaction, that's gonna be in your view models. Model entities, generally just plain old CLR objects with properties, but often they need to support a notify property change so that you can change those behind the scenes and have the changes reflected on screen through data binding. Business logic, probably is some, whether it's part of the same solution, kind of two-tier app style, you can certainly still do that in UWP, or more often I would say apps are being built to be more end-tier and having a service backend that can be placed, you know, in the cloud or wherever you need it to be. And so that business logic may be actually hosted somewhere else behind the bounds of a service, but the idea is, you know, in a good layered fashion, it's separated out from the UI code. And what just popped in there? Oh, there we go. Data access, same kind of concept, should be decoupled from the upper layers and kind of logically sitting underneath the business logic. And then finally, shared client logic, and I'll touch on that in a different slide here, what I mean by that. So MVVM itself is a layered architecture for the client side, is kind of what it's all about. The view is all about what you see on the screen. It's supported by a view model, like I just talked about, and those two, let me just get through the animation there. View and view model talk to each other primarily through data bindings, but also through commands that can come down from the view to the view model. The model objects aren't a layer to themselves, really, because they're going to transition through these layers. You'll probably populate them down here in the client services layer. You'll pass them up or pull them up into your view model, and then you'll expose them so that the view can data bind to those model objects, or at least properties that come from those model objects. In terms of responsibilities, like I just talked about, primary responsibility of the model is to contain the client data, expose relationships between different model objects, so having things that are called navigation properties where you can go from customer to their collection of orders, from an individual order to a product, and so on. Possibly some computed properties, get, you know, the canonical example of a full name from a first name and last name. And then because you'll often be data binding directly to these things, you'll want to make sure that you can raise property change notifications from them so that the screen stays in sync. And one other thing in terms of logic that might go on your model objects is validation logic. Don't have to do it this way, but you know, these days we've got the data annotation library that's part of the .NET. It's very easy to decorate your properties, say this is required, it's got a string length of this, a numeric range of whatever, and even custom validation. And so that's typically the way you would decorate your model with the validation rules associated with it. There's always validation that you have to do on the back end. Things where you gotta go look up when was the last time this customer bought a product from us. And that's a separate kind of validation. This, I'm just talking about that stuff that can be easily known by the client side in sort of a static fashion. In terms of the view itself, I always describe it as the structural definition of what the user sees on the screen. Keeping in mind that can be dynamic or static. So primarily we think in terms of the static, you know, we put together grids inside grids with stack panels and that kind of stuff to get the general layout of the screen. The idea is that the view shouldn't be responsible for populating itself. In MVVM, the thing that populates the view is data bindings that point to things exposed by the view model. So there's also this goal of no code behind. You'll hear this brought up a lot in the context of MVVM. And let me just jump over to some code to kind of emphasize that. So here we're in a view. Let's go to the code. And this is, when we say no code behind, this is really what people mean. It's not truly no code behind, but it's just the minimal code that makes that thing, you know, a view that can come into being in a XAML platform. Now, that's a goal. It's not always possible to stay that way. In simple demos that you see at conferences, usually is. But when you go and start building real stuff, and especially if you're doing things like pulling in third-party component libraries, often to get those super rich features that those, you know, super fragilistic grids have, you have to do something like call a method, set a property that maybe is designed in a weird way that you can't easily set it through data binding. So those kinds of things do belong here. Even though it's code that is directly touching, it has to directly touch UI elements to do what they need to do. So, you know, don't feel like you're doing it wrong if you have to put some of that code back here, but do feel like you're doing it wrong if you start putting code in here that makes service calls, that does lookups against the database, that does calculations, things like that. That stuff should be back in the view model at least, or possibly all the way back in a business layer on the server side. All right, so that gets to the view model. And obviously the view model is kind of the focus of the pattern. That's where a lot of stuff happens, but the counter tendency here is don't make it the God object. Okay, you know, this pattern's all about good separation of concerns, keeping your socks and your pants and your shirts and your underwear separate. So don't make it that you have one drawer for socks and then all those other things go into the view model. You know, you still wanna have a good separation of different responsibilities. So a lot of times you'll hear people talk about the view model is where your business logic goes. I hate that term because to me, business logic, generally, as much as possible, should be on the back end behind a service boundary so that it can be reused by multiple client applications. So one of the primary jobs of the view model is to expose data to the view in the way the view wants to see it. And what I mean by that is you may have a complex model, a business model for your data that you expose to the client side, but the shape of that data may not be exactly what you need on the client side for binding. And I'll elaborate on that a little bit more in a couple slides. The kind of logic you also put in your view model is, I call it interaction logic. So it's that logic that says the user just did something. What needs to happen next? It's not the full details of how you do those things. It's sort of the workflow of the user did this, now I need to either navigate to a different screen, I change some other property that's part of the view model so that something on my current screen changes, stuff like that. So in terms of the way you expose the model and the model possibly being different from the way the view wants to see it, often you'll just have a property that is a model object. If you've got a screen that is customer details and you've got a customer object that encapsulates all those details, then it's natural to just expose a typed property of customer from your view model and data bind to that. So this, we could talk about that as exposing the model from your view model. You might also have, oops, I went too far. You might also have something like this where it's just a value really, a single valued property that you expose from your view model, but its value comes from something in the model. Picture maybe a customer status enumeration that's part of your customer object, and based on that, you wanna say, should I show the advanced options for dealing with this customer? So you're doing a transformation there from the way the data is represented in the model itself to the way the view needs to see it, which is a Boolean flag it can bind to. Now, the example that always comes up here, just to point out, there's always the purities of the pattern, and then there's also the pragmatic, I gotta get something done and ship product. And so this is an example where often what do you do with the bool? Well, you might want to hide and show something, of course. How do you hide and show something in XAML? You use a visibility flag. So why not just expose a visibility property here instead of a Boolean one that you'll then have to put a converter on to turn it into a visibility. And you know, the simple get it done and ship it answer is go for it. Put a visibility property on there. Now the purest MVVM perspective is don't do that. The view model should never be dictating anything to do with how things are presented to the user. It just provides the logic and data to support doing that, and it's the view's responsibility to determine how the user sees things. So having something like a visibility property is dictating whether they see something or not. It's borderline. It's really just a data structure. Where's the harm? Well, one harm is that visibility is a property that's defined in your platform. If you want to take that same code and turn it into a Xamarin app, you just blocked yourself. If you have a visibility property, if you have a Boolean property, you can take that view model and go use it with Xamarin, and they have their own visibility property that you can have a converter that turns it into the right thing. So that's another aspect to consider on what you put in your view model. If you have any intention of making that a cross-platform view model, then you don't want to put anything in the view model code that's going to lock you into a single platform. Another thing you might do is something like this, where the way the view wants to see something, say in this case, you want to present a order history, maybe the last 10 orders that a customer made. And the requirement says show the order date, what they ordered, and how many of them. And then you go look at your data model and go, oh, one piece is here, one piece is there, one piece is there in totally separate objects. So this is another one of those responsibilities of a view model, is to shape the data into something that's easily data bindable from the view. Now this thingy down here, this order item, sometimes people will name these with view model. Totally a preference thing. There's no black helicopter is going to come get you if you do that. I prefer, in terms of clarity of the code, nothing's a view model unless it has a corresponding view. It may be dynamic which view it links up to, but that's different than an object just exposed for data binding purposes from a view model. This one is technically not part of your model. It's a helper object you're creating to shape the data for data binding purposes, which is part of the view model responsibility. So I typically use naming like item, info, something like that, just to delineate these, and I don't put them, for example, in my models folder because they're not really part of the core data model. They're a derivative object just to shape the data. So we call that wrapping either the bool property or the collection of something else. You'll hear people talk about wrapping the model, and that's where basically your data bindings don't point directly to model objects. They point to other properties of the view model that expose data that came from the model objects. And there's always other data as well that's not part of the model. So you may have some aspect of client application state, whether the user's logged in or not, whether you have a network connection or not. Those are more client state, but they're often things you need to data bind to, and maybe have some logic surrounding what the view does based on that. And so those are things you'll typically expose as properties from your view model as well. Any questions so far? It's kind of bright up here, so yell out if you have a question. Now this third layer, as I always refer to it, let me go back a couple of slides here. Back a ways. Where is it? Oh, you know what? I'm thinking of my slide deck from yesterday. No, there it is. So in this, I always refer to this as the third layer. So you've got the MVVM, or really VVVM, you get the idea. But those are all part of the pattern technically, part of its name even. This third layer, as I refer to it, is also an important part of applying this pattern. And it's another one of these things where you can go ahead and put everything that happens from the point where a user clicks a button or a view is being populated with data, you can put every single aspect of that into your view model. But that, again, becomes a point of putting too much code of different types in one place. Generally, you want to design your view models to not have to know the how of what they need, just the what. And what I mean by that is if you have a customer screen, the view model should be able to say, give me customers. But it shouldn't have to know, where do I go to get customers? Am I making a web API call? Am I going directly to a database? Maybe I'm reading it out of client-side cache. Those are the how. And so that's the type of stuff you encapsulate down here in the client services layer. So much like a business logic layer being separated from the presentation layer, this stuff up here is really all presentation layer stuff. It's not business logic per se, or could be depending on the scale of the app, but it's, you know, kind of the gory details of how do I get those things done? Where do I go to know whether the user's logged in or not, or that I have a network connection? Those are all kind of the how, and that those belong down in this third layer called client services or repositories. Sure. So it would definitely still be a client-side construct, and often I'll just dump them into the view models folder because they are part of the model, the view model definition, really. But I don't specifically call the type name something view model because I don't want those objects to be confused with those things that actually get hooked directly to a view as its data context. Does that make sense? Now, if they're a reusable object that, you know, maybe depending on how you go about this, I'll talk a little bit at the end. With Prism, there's this concept of modularity and breaking out different sets of functionality into different modules that are decoupled from one another. We don't have full support for that yet in Prism for UWP, but in terms of how you structure your code, people will often do that. So if it's some type, let's say a customer info, that you're gonna grab different aspects of properties from the data model, but then that same thing is used by, say, your, you know, in an Outlook sense, your inbox and your calendar functionality, but the inbox may be in one DLL, the calendar functionality may be in a different DLL. So if you have larger scale use of those info objects, then you might put them in a shared library that's referenced from both those other ones. Give my airways a moment to calm down. All right, sorry about that. I've got a weird lung condition. I get these sudden coughing fits. So yes, I agree that if it's a one-to-one kind of thing, then usually I'd rather just expose the model object and bind to its properties. But I'm specifically showing an example here where that, you know, single thing I want to data bind to in a list-oriented sense doesn't exist in the model, and there's no way I can say, give me a collection of the join of three objects and let me data bind to individual properties of it. Well, you could with anonymous objects and link, but then you're just dynamically creating this order item to do that. And it's got to be done somewhere, and it would be done down in the view model. Okay, so these client services or repositories, I already talked about in general what they would do. They're there to decouple the view model from the how things get done and let the view model just focus on what do I need to support the view for dynamic data and user interaction. All right, so now starting to get to the code and some of the fundamentals here. I always refer to this as the fundamental equation of MVVM. At the end of the day, when you're doing MVVM, you have a view. You have a view model, those are instances of objects. They need a relationship to one another, and that relationship is that the view.data context should equal the view model instance. There are many ways of getting that done. I mentioned, you know, several of them here, and we'll just look at some of these in code. So get my glasses on so I can see what I'm doing here. All right, so the sample app I'm gonna be using here is just a simple little sample app. Let's run it so you can see it. Yes. So notice down at the bottom there, deploy succeeded. This relates back to what I was saying about the extensibility earlier, that, you know, part of when you F5 run a UWP app, it's not only compiling that code into libraries, it's then bundling those libraries into an AppX package and actually deploying that to your local instance of Windows 10. And that's why you can't have true runtime extensibility of your objects and apps. So here we pull in some data dynamically from a cloud-based web API. We can go and put a product or list our products and start putting together a pizza order. And just in case anyone was unclear, if you thought this was a user experience design session, hopefully it's clear now. Go to Billy for that. But you can see, you've got some basic interaction here. You've got navigation from screen to screen. You've got interaction within views. These could be their own view and view model, depending on the complexity, or they could just be part of the containing view. You know, having one button in a chunk of stuff is generally, to me, not enough interaction to warrant having its own view model, but maybe there's all kinds of, things that happen when you click that button that maybe change how that view is rendered and so on, then it might make sense to have its own view model here. And we could submit that order to the back end. So that's the basic functionality we're looking at here, and then we'll focus on how this all comes together in terms of UWP. So structurally, notice I have a views folder, a view models folder, and a services folder, and a models folder, all in one place because this is a small sample demo app. As I showed in the slides, in real world apps, you might put the models at least into their own class library, especially if those model objects are shared with a backend or a service. The services here, always got to kind of keep in mind that's that overloaded term of service. This doesn't mean backend web service. That would almost certainly be in a separate project. This is the client-side services or repositories, that third layer is what I would put in there. And then the choice to use views and view model subfolder, that's totally an arbitrary one. An equally viable alternative is to have feature folders. So I have stuff to do with orders. So I have an orders folder, and then I have my views and view models side by side in that orders folder. Or maybe I have views and view models subfolders of that orders folder. It all depends on how complex your app is and how many things are going to end up in that folder. Generally you don't want a single folder with 25 views and view models in there. It's just too hard to find anything in there. UWP, whenever you do file new projects, so starting point for this demo would just be a file new project, Windows application. Got to get the right kind of universal project. So Microsoft, with their wonderful naming of things, go into Windows, and this is the right universal, not this universal. Totally separate platform, but let's use the same term almost. But that's why we refer to it as UWP. That's a distinct term that is only referred to on Windows 10. If you talk about universal apps, then you get a lot of, in terms of searching for solutions and stuff, you get a lot of false hits for Windows 8 stuff that may not apply. So my starting point on this one was nothing more than a blank app template here. The application class itself, as a starting point of putting together an app and doing MVVM, you shouldn't have to mess with this a whole lot. The only thing I changed here because of my choice to put all my views down here in a views folder is that I still have main page is what you have out at the root level by default. I just moved it in here, changed its namespace to match the folder, and then re-resolved it right here as a type so that we have a using statement up here that points into that child namespace. Now for the construction of the views and view models, as I mentioned, there's a number of ways to go about it. View first XAML construction. Let's see if I have one of those here. No, not that one. No, that one's implicit. Yeah, so none of these are actually doing it right now, but what I'm referring to is if you do something like this, page.dataContext, remember view.dataContext equals view model. So we could do, I'll just pseudocode it here, local, what are we in here? We're in order view, so it would be order view model, maybe. So by the nature of the way XAML parsing happens here, it comes here and it's really just setting the data context property of the page element that's at the root. And then when it encounters this element, it parses it, calls the default constructor of that object, and then sets it as the value for the property that you're setting with this syntax. So that, you know, puts together that marriage relationship of view.dataContext equals view model. The downside of doing it this way is mainly one. If that view model needs something else to function, such as a reference to a service layer object, and you don't want to have, you don't want that view model to have to construct that itself, maybe it's a shared instance that gets injected into all the view models, you don't really have an opportunity to do that here, because this is always going to call the default constructor. So then you might go to doing it in the code behind. So let's go in here. And really all we mean there is just, you know, the programmatic equivalent of that. So this.dataContext equals new, what is this one again? Order view model. And because you're doing it programmatically here, as long as you can somehow have access to the objects that view model needs, you could do a manual dependency injection here as you're constructing it. But then that always raises the challenge of how the heck does this code behind for a view get access to some third layer? It's a first layer object, and it's supposed to get a third layer object reference to inject into a second layer object. Hopefully that sounds kind of screwy to you from an architecture perspective. So this really doesn't buy you a whole lot unless you're using a dependency injection framework and you construct this thing through the container and let the container worry about the injection of dependencies. And then the view model locator is a popular way to go with this. If you use one of the frameworks that I'll mention at the end, Prism, MVVM Lite, MVVM Cross, all have these, and Caliber Micro, I believe, does too. And basically the idea here is, you know, anytime a view is coming into being, when you're doing MVVM, you have the same thing to do over and over and over again. Construct the view model, set the data context of the view to the view model. Sounds like a great case for automation. And that's basically what a view model locator is all about. I think I've got one of those in this sample. If not, I don't have it in this sample. I'll show it in the next demo. But let's just bring that up. Now, instead of showing how to build one of these yourself for this session, if you're going to go down the route of using a view model locator, definitely just use one of the frameworks. So the other project I'm going to open up here is actually using Prism, exactly the same app, but with Prism integrated, and just to show what it looks like to do that hookup. So right up here, you see this attach property. And so there's a couple different ways to go about doing a view model locator. But the idea is, you know, from a coding perspective and a writing declarative code perspective, that first way I showed of just having the view model hooked up in the XAML, usually the XAML is the first thing you go look at to get a sense of what the structure of that view is. And so having it right there at the top saying, you know, this is my view model and how it gets hooked up is kind of a good thing. One minor downside to that, again, is coupling. Now the view has to explicitly know about its view type, and again, can't do anything complex in terms of the construction of that object. So what view model locator here tries to do is gives you that benefit of kind of declarative approach that's right in your face when you open a view, but it takes away the aspect of saying this has to know specifically what view model and how to construct it. So it basically just has this declarative aspect that says, yes, this is an MVVM view. Go figure out, based on convention, what its view model should be, construct it, do dependency injection if you need to, and then set it as the data context. And so the Prism view model locator has all that wrapped up in it. And then what else did I have in here? Oh yeah, so the last one here, how many people in here again did WPF? So in WPF, we have this awesome feature called implicit data templates, where you can declare a data template and say the data type of that template is some object, a data object or a view model object that you're going to end up data binding to. And the data binding mechanisms of WPF then kick in, create an instance of that data template, and set its data context equal to the data object it's being rendered for, which should sound kind of familiar by this point. Data context of the root object equals some data object. Well, I said a view model is all about offering up data to the view. It really is a data object itself and can be directly bound to. So it's unfortunate that we don't have implicit data templates yet, but you can still do that kind of construction. So back over here, if we look at our main view, or main page view, you can see that all we have in terms of content here is a content control. So content control is just kind of a visual container. It doesn't have any presentation itself. It's just like a placeholder to plug other content into. And so what we can do here is simulate implicit data templates by having named data templates that follow a convention, such as their name is what view they correspond to with template on the end of it. And then their contents are the view itself. So when a data template is rendered based on data binding, it creates an instance of that root object again and sets the data context of it. So what this means is we can then data bind up here for the content control. You can see that we can expose a view model property from the view model for this view. So this is setting up a MVVM hierarchy. We've got our main page as our container view, our parent view, and then it's going to be plugging different child views into this content control inside of that parent view. Could just be a side panel or a main content panel, something like that. In this case, it's just going to fill the whole view. And so then its view model, again, how does this thing get hooked up to its view model? That is a good question. So here's the main page view model. And if we go find references, we can see it's being newed up down here in the code behind. So this is, you know, an example where I chose to do it as code behind. I could have done it declaratively in the XAML because it's just calling the default constructor anyway. So that gets newed up and wired up there. And then you can see as part of its construction, it creates both of its child view models. So this doesn't scale well if you're going to have dozens of child views that could plug in there. But you can, you know, if it's a few discrete things that you're going to switch within your content control, you can just new them up as child view models here. And then when something happens that causes navigation to occur, you can see here in this case, it's our place order button on that first view. Then we can go and change this child view model property. Now to do that, you have to have a common base class on those things. You could just use object, but you're gonna want something like this bindable base, which is basically encapsulating the implementation of iNotify property change. So you don't have to go re-implement that on every object you're gonna data bind to. So this is stolen if anyone, you know, those of you who may have played around with Windows 8 development, in Windows 8, Visual Studio used to emit this in a common folder when you created a new Windows 8 project, and they called it bindable base, and it was almost identical code-wise. So you always need something like this. If you use a framework like Prism or MVVM Lite, they have one of these things for you that you can just inherit from. So you can see we make it so that each of our view models, see those are views, these are view models, each of our view models inherit from that, so they implement iNotify property change, and it makes it so their exposed properties for data binding can be simple and just call set property. And under the covers of set property, it checks and says, did the value actually change? Is the new one different than the old one? If so, then go ahead and raise the property change and set that value into the private variable of the class. Other things going on here, you can see data binding to collections. You know, those can still just be model objects that you put into a collection and populate. But the way we're actually loading those is we're going out and making a web service call here to actually get, well, I'm sorry, these are just the images. The products themselves are coming out of this data repository.instance. So this is what I'm trying to show here is kind of a logical progression that you don't have to have all the concepts in place at once. You can kind of do the crude, straightforward thing that's maybe not as decoupled as you want it in the end to get there. So in this case, I'm just doing, you know, kind of a crude singleton pattern in .NET where you expose a static instance type property and then you lazy load the first time it's called, you create the real instance, and then every time after that, you just return the existing instance. So that gives us a singleton for this data repository, and if we wanted to cache some of the products that came in, we could do that down inside of this singleton. You know, as you evolve into more mature MVVM coding, what you end up with is you're going to want to learn how to use dependency injection, and you're probably going to want to adopt a container for that, either Unity or AutoFac or MEF or Structure Map or Simple, what's it called, Simple Container, or there's a bunch of them in Inject. There's a lot to choose from out there. This one is just doing manual dependency injection and, you know, crude tricks like this static singleton. The problem with that in the big scheme of things from a testability perspective is, say you wanted to write a unit test for this thing, you're kind of screwed because statics just don't work well with unit tests. You want to be able to mock out this call in your unit test, and when you've structured it this way, you really have no opportunity to do that. So that's where dependency injection comes in, that if instead of this, you just were injecting, conceptually up here, an iData repository, and either manually, can't type and talk, repository. You know, you could either manually inject that from maybe the app startup so that it's a singleton type model, or better yet is use a container and have the container responsible for newing up that view model. The container will look and say, to do that, I need one of these, so I'll go construct one of those and inject it, and every subsequent time, I'll just inject the next one, the same one as a singleton. So those are things, you know, you'll want to evolve into. There's nothing specific about that when it comes to UWP versus WPF versus Silverlight, all those XAML platforms. Doing that dependency injection is more a matter of picking a container and just learning how to register stuff with that container and then resolve them. Okay, how are we doing on time? 15. All right. So a few other things that are going on here. So I started showing the dynamic loading of the child views here. And so it starts with exposing this child view model that we populate in a crude fashion to navigate, if you will, between views. And the way it actually works to get those rendered then, because we don't have implicit data templates in UWP, we do have a thing called a data template selector. And so there's an extra property here on content controls and items controls that let you point to a data template selector. And then that data template selector, you can see here, inherits from the base class and then overrides this select template method, basically. And it all it really gives you is it says, this is the object that's being created, and this is the containing object that it's within in the XAML tree. And then from there, you can write your own logic to say, you have to come up with a way to write the logic to say, okay, that's great. You know, what object do I want to create to provide the data template that's actually going to be used? And that's where my convention came in here, is that if the object that shows up in this data bound property is a a customer's view model, then I chop off the model, add template, and look in my resources and expect to find that data template. Just one way of going about it. And that's basically what the logic in here is doing. You can see it's chopping off the view model part, and then appending template is basically, and then it looks into the resources dictionary for the element that this data template selector is contained on. So you can build little pieces of infrastructure like this to help you in applying the MVVM patterns. And you can see some of those sitting. So that one sits there. We've got that bindable base I showed you there. Another one I haven't really focused on yet is the calls from the view down into the view model. And that's typically done with commands. So you're usually going to need something like this delegate command class, which again, you can write your own. It, you know, fits almost in a page of code here. Or you can go use a library like Prism or MVVM Lite that already have these built in for you. So all of our buttons, for example, let's see, where's a button? Here's a button. All of our buttons, you can see we hook that up by using the command property of the button, and we expect our view model to expose a property of type I command that we can bind to there. So place order command down on the customer's view model. Here we can see we just expose a property, Generally, you can do a private set here because you're going to construct the instance of the delegate command on construction, which you can see right here, and point it to its handling method. So the I command has a can execute and an execute method on it, and you can supply handlers for both of those aspects of the command. So that's another common piece of infrastructure you're going to need to do MVVM correctly. Another little MVVM trick you'll see here in both of my child views is this nasty looking little piece of code. This is leveraging blend behaviors. So behaviors is kind of a big topic on its own. I've got a whole course on it in the Pluralsight library if you want to check that out. But this is just leveraging a built-in behavior in the behaviors SDK called call method action. And that is a thing that you can point to an object. What is binding? Well, remember the fundamental equation. Binding with nothing on it means bind to the whole data context object. What is the whole data context object? It's our view model by convention in MVVM. So we can say, I know that that will point me to my view model, and I want to call some method on it, in this case called onload. Because often you have, inside of a view model, you've got that problem that often you're going out and making something like a service call, which you're typically going to do async, and you can't do async calls inside of a constructor in .NET. So you kind of have to have a separate method that's called sometime after construction that goes and does that async work to go get your data. And so this is one way of going about it, is basically hook, you know, through a behavior here, you can see it has a trigger that is hooking the loaded event to the view and then dispatching a call into some method on your view model. And now you have that separation, kind of a two-phase construction process. If you go to a framework like Prism, Prism has a built-in concept of navigation that's tied to this view switching type of mechanism. So in Prism, you can inherit from a view model base class that knows about the switching. You can see it injects the site navigation service so it can control that, and it overrides a onNavigated to that'll happen sometime after construction. So like with Prism, and there's similar constructs in some of the other MVVM libraries, instead of having to do that behavior trick to get that second phase of construction, you can get it through a navigation mechanism in one of the MVVM libraries. All right, so that kind of shows all these different forms of getting, you know, a view is generally going to be constructed by UWP itself. Your top level page, you saw that at a starting point, you have to specify that as a type in the startup of your application. From that point, when you go to a different page, you do it through frame navigation. So you can use the frame class yourself. That's a UI object, so really that code should reside in the view. And that's where Prism, for example, wraps that UI object in an interface-based abstraction so that you can use it from your view models and not hurt your testability. This just kind of shows in pictures what I was showing in the demo there, that you know, as the XAML parsing, so backing up here to the view first and declarative in the XAML, it says part of the parsing process that's kicked off by that initialized component call and the code behind, that starts ripping through the XAML and setting the property to an instance of a view model. I'll just skip over the words on those because I already covered them. So this is that, you know, kind of four-step process I was talking about that can be encapsulated into something like a view model locator. Data binding is obviously very important in the context of MVVM. First and foremost, it sets up that relationship between the view and the view model. And the point of that relationship is so that all the other parts inside that view know how to get to stuff that's exposed by their view model, because that data context cascades down the visual tree by default on all the XAML platforms, and then your bindings inside your view can just point to an exposed model object or a discrete property that's exposed by your view model, including things like commands, as I just showed in the demo. I guess I can hang up that call. Other kinds of communication, like I said, from view down to view model, if it's the way I think about it is, if it's a user invoked thing, then you should always do that with commands. But there's sometimes that something happens in the view, maybe let's use like control getting focus. Okay, yes, that's done by the user, But it's one of those things that they're just changing focus. They're not explicitly saying, make something in the background happen now. But there's often cases where, because something got focused, you want to go recompute a computed property maybe, and you know, have the data binding property change notification update the UI. So for those kinds of things, I don't typically use a command. You could, but for those, you can use something like that behavior I just showed to do a call a method on the view model. Or there's other built-in behaviors for changing properties, setting properties instead of calling methods. So you can do that kind of thing. Data binding itself already forms a two-directional communication path. If you change a property on the view model, because of I notify property change, it's gonna set something in the view. You can do kind of the same thing from the view's perspective, that just the act of setting a property, such as selected, pushes a call down to the view model, sets some property on the view model through data binding, and that property set block can have logic in it that makes other things happen. Another form of communication that's very common in doing MVVM is PubSub messaging. In Prism, it's based on Prism and Caliburn Micro, it's based on a pattern called event aggregator. And the idea is that you don't want the publisher and the subscriber to have to know anything about each other. You don't want lifetime coupling between the objects, and you don't want direct referencing between them for communication. So it just gives you an infrastructure for somewhere in the code, possibly, you know, think a left pane and right pane, each have a view and a view model. Something happens in the left pane, you want to tell the right pane to update. You can do it by simply publishing from the left pane, and then the right pane is subscribing to whatever that event is. And these are not .NET events. They're really just method calls, but they're done through an intermediary called the event aggregator so that those two things don't have to know about each other. Commands I just kind of showed in the code. This pattern's been around for a long time. It's in the Gang of Four design patterns book. It talks in abstract terms about an invoker. The invoker is usually a UI control like a button. Keep in mind there's lots of controls that could be the invoker, and almost none of those have a command pattern other than button. So things like a list box can be the invoker when selection occurs, but the only way you're going to get that selection dispatched to your view model so it can do something about it is one of two ways. Use a behavior called invoke command action, where you can wire up to the selection changed event on the list box and then fire a command into the view model to make something happen. Or in a property oriented way, you can just data bind the selected item property of that view model to some property on your view model and have the logic kick off from the set block like I talked about before. The receiver, that's typically going to be a method inside of your view model that gets called through that delegate command. When you start building out something a little more real, this is the kind of environment you're typically going to end up with, is that you have a hierarchical set of views and view models. There's always some kind of root concept, often called a shell.xaml and a shell view model. And those often will set up the top level navigation like I was showing in my demo. But then inside that, you might have side-by-side panes like I show here. And especially in the context of UWP, we've got a top-level container control called split view that would do exactly this kind of a setup for you and let you plug a view into the left part of the split view that's generally reserved for navigation type stuff. And then there's a main content area of the list view that you would plug, probably dynamically based on selections in the left part. You would dynamically plug in the child views that are going to go in the details area. But inside that details, you may have sub panels and stuff, depending on how big and complicated that app is, and each one of those could be view and view model pairs. When it comes to navigation, I mentioned this in words earlier, the frame class is the thing you need to cause a page to swap out in UWP. But the logic when you're doing MVVM that says, when should I navigate and where should I navigate to, that's interaction logic that should be in your view model. So you don't want to take a direct dependency on frame in your view model if you care about testability and trying to follow the pattern, because like I said, that's a UI element. So you can just wrap it in some kind of an abstraction that has an interface. have that interface injected into your view model, and that's how it can depend on that and make calls to say, navigate to page two by calling through that interface boundary. And then you can have page two spin up. It creates its own view model in one of those several ways I talked about. And it can be, you can set it up so this calls the old view model, telling it you're about to go away, you might need to do some cleanup. And then it can call, construct the page and call the new view model to say, go ahead and initialize yourself, like with that on navigation call I showed in the Prism example. Application lifecycle, let me just bring this all up, is another thing that's kind of unique to UWP that you have to get used to. Now, this is one of those areas that they relax things quite a bit. In Windows 8, there was very strict guidance about what happens in each of these transitions in terms of the state of your application data. And what we're really talking about here is transient data. The user has filled out 15 of 20 input fields, and you haven't saved it anywhere yet. Or they've scrolled to item 19 out of 257 items. That's transient state about the application, that if your app goes off screen, especially when you're in tablet mode in UWP and it's back to kind of a full screen model for apps, once it goes off screen, it gets suspended. And then it may come back directly from suspension, like this little loop in the middle here, in which case, while it's suspended, it has no threads of execution, but everything in memory is exactly where it was. So all your object relationships, you know, what control in the object model is selected, where you are, scroll position, all the 15 fields that they filled in, it's the same place it always was while the application was running. But there's just no threads of execution doing anything with that memory while you're in suspension. The one that is still kind of recommended guidance, but not explicitly required, like it was in Windows 8, is this terminated one. Once you go into suspension, you open up your email, you open up Twitter, you open up Facebook, you open up 10 different apps. At some point, it's not gonna have enough memory for all those apps to be sitting in memory. So what it'll do at that point is pick a victim, generally the one with the most memory that has been dormant the longest, and it'll just kill it, terminate it, basically wipe that memory clean and let some other program use it. And the problem with that is that you have no opportunity to do anything at the point where that occurs. You are told when you're going to be suspended through an event, but then your app is dormant and never executes again if it goes through the terminated state. So you have to kind of proactively save all that transient data so that when you launch again from terminated, you can restore the user experience to where they were before. Now, if it's closed by user, they're shutting down the app, you should be prompting them to save anything that's, you know, transient and that kind of stuff. That's more your burden to structure the application appropriately. But this suspended to terminate link is the more challenging one, and it's inherently part of the platform, so you wanna have some way of dealing with that. Now they have some events at a page level that tell you about that stuff. But again, the page shouldn't be managing the data, the view model should when you're doing MVVM. So this is another place where frameworks can help you out. Prism has built-in support for this. Let's see, do I have, yeah, I've got a Hello World sample that shows this. Oh man, I'm over time. I'm sorry, I wasn't watching the time close enough. So let me just, instead of showing it, I'll just kind of explain. The demos are all out there. You can see the link here. They'll also be up on the site. What I was gonna show is there's just a tag you can put on your properties, a restorable state attribute if you're using Prism, and it will take care of that state suspension stuff for you. So there are a couple Pluralsight courses you can check out there that supplement what I went through here. There's also a great series of videos on UWP development in general. And in that, they often use this template 10 is another MVVM-ish framework that's being built up by Jared Nixon, the Microsoft guy out of Denver. So that's another alternative. Prism, I'm the co-owner of the open source Prism project, so that's part of the reason I tend to use that, not surprisingly, but all of these are great options in terms of a framework that you could adopt that helps you do all this stuff I've been talking about. So with that, sorry for going over a few minutes. There's the resources, there's the demos. Please fill out your evals and enjoy the rest of the conference.